Accession number 14963, reel 4.
Wigman, reel 4. Can we go on to the operations in detail, please?
Yes, the... I can't obviously remember all the details of each incident that we had, and maybe they're not in the first order as we got them, but the earlier days with the flying bomb sites, a Foydib I've mentioned is one, Le Cotillier was another one. I think that was an army support job because, I believe it was. I can remember now, I don't know if I have the right name, I think Le Cotillier, the army was held up at Caen. The Canadians were held up and there were Germans were putting up a lot of resistance. They were moving up panzers there. And we had some instructions. We had to go over. It was a daylight sortie. And of all things, we had a 200-yard bomb line. Now, this bomb line was our front line troops. They were Canadians. And 200 yards ahead of them were the Germans and the German panzers. And we had to remove what we could of those and the roads behind them. But we had this, and front line troops would be firing off yellow cartridges to know where they were situated as we came over. So we went over. The Parker, the PFF marked the area, and we went on. Not low, but low for us. We went in there, and I suppose there are 200 or 300 Halifax on that job. And we did, and we did sort them out, and the army did move forward from that trip. And I particularly remember that one because Kay's brother, one night after the war, we were talking some time after the war, he was in the army, he was a signals, and he was on that front, held up by this thing. And he remembered how the bombers came over, and they had never heard such a crescendo of noise of these bombs going off so close, and of course the German flak going up. And they said, as far as he knew, in his area, not one bomb penetrated their own front line, that 200-yard bomb line. But they did move forward. When the raid was finished, they moved forward, no problem. So obviously that was a success. I believe we lost several Halifaxes on that trip, but I can't remember the actual figures. That was one in particular. Another one, which was a sea trip. We had a summer day going down to Brest, and they were bringing in supplies into Brest. They got these ships in there. Our job was to bomb the ships that were moored at the wharves and the inner harbour with the tanks and things that they were bringing in there. That was all right. We had quite a hectic time over Brest itself, but we did get a good view of the ship, and I don't think we hit one, but we did hit the wharves alongside of one of them, near as we could say. But nevertheless, we came back. It was a nice, easy trip, really.
It seems to be the 24th of August, according to your logbook.
Well, that would be right then. I know it was a nice summer's day. And I can't remember another one in particular, but we did go on to Dijon. Now, that was a rough trip. Dijon, the marshalling yards at Dijon. That was a night trip. And that was rough. The searchlights and guns were pretty hectic. And we had a bit of fighter activity there too. And that was a long trip. That wasn't particularly nice. But there's... of course, we did intermix with this lot on the Ruhr. The Ruhr was our happy hunting ground because we had the right fuel capacity for that. We had the right range we could get a good bomb load on. But it was monotonous. There was Duisburg and... Duisburg, yes, that reflects on what I remember now. We had to. It was an operation. I think it was something like Operation Thunderclap. Some silly word like that. We were going to bomb the oil refineries because our main target, Eisenhower, had released us to go on to strategic bombing again, and we the oil supplies and factories. previously that we'd been on under Eisenhower's command for tactical bombing for the army. And we went on to Duisburg, this particular one, though that come back, that was a summer morning, and the whole essence of that, the prop fell off. But anyway, we lined up on the runway. It must have been about 7 o'clock in the morning. I opened up the throttles, and I heard a bang. I thought, well, what's that? I didn't think anything of it, as it was running anyway, so off we went. So we got full throttle, got airborne, and bring it back to plus 6,2400, which is a climbing revs and boost, which she climbed away at nicely. But then the port outer wouldn't throttle back. I saw the revs were standing there, and I thought, that's funny. So I pulled it back farther, and the boost came off, but the revs went up, and went up to 3,000 thereabouts. So I thought, hello, we've got trouble here. So I opened up the other engines, and climbing up, and she wouldn't climb. I had a full bomb load, full fuel load, and I had to formate on the other characters up above, but I couldn't reach them. So I thought, I'm on three engines now. I couldn't make it, so I turned towards Farley Bay. I thought, well, I've got to get rid of this bomb load, because this thing isn't going to last too long like this, and if it goes down, we don't want it to, you know, scatter over the countryside. I went out to Farley Bay, dropped the load, jettisoned the bombs, and came back, and this time, the air screw was bouncing up and down. It was like a wheel about to come off a car, rising up and down. It must have been going up about a foot, I think. That's what it looked like anyway. See, the thing was going mad, 3,500 revs. Of course, the maximum revs were about 2,400. We're coming back, and I remember looking at Cliff, who was sitting alongside of me, and saying to him, wait, whirling my hand around, which way does it go round? I meant the prop. Does it go to the left? Does it go to the right? For the life of me, I couldn't remember. I was thinking which way it goes and which way it's going to fly off and hit the other engine, or will it go to the other side and not and clear the aeroplane? And of course, that time, then the flame started on that engine, started burning. It was the oil coming out, oil leaking over the hot exhaust, and the flames were coming back, and the prop was going up and down. It wouldn't feather, and it made it worse, because if you can feather an air screw, it means you bring it edge on to the slipstream, and it stops. But no, it wouldn't do anything. The oil was pouring out, and the thing was on fire. So, well, this isn't very funny. We're heading back to Leckerfield then from Farley Bay, and, you know, it's one of those QNIM types of morning. And there was a lovely great shower cloud. I must have been the only one in the sky, and it was situated over Leckerfield. And looking around, you know, I couldn't see those runways anywhere. Cliff couldn't see them. A beautiful wet morning over that there, and I thought, well, it's got to be under that cloud. Leckerfield's not showing up. I've seen Beverly, so I know where it is. Anyway, we went across there, and the cloud was moving fairly quickly. I could see then the airfield appearing from underneath it. So I thought, well, this had to happen, so I flew along there and flew alongside the runway, and we banged off a red. I got the boys down in the rest position at this time, got their parachutes on, but I thought, well, we don't want to jump them out at this height, because we're getting down to about 800 feet now, if we can get it back in again. It's getting a bit low for these, you know, on top of which, of course, I thought, well, I won't get out at the end of it if I do, so we get them back in again, and it was on fire, so banged off this red, and up came on the RT calling me and said, have you got an emergency? So I said, well, we've got a bit of trouble. We've got an engine on fire. So I said, Roger. And that was the end of that. So he came round. Came round to make a landing. I was number one to land, obviously. And came on round. And suddenly, everything quietened down. The prop fell off. The whole front of the engine fell off. And with it went the fire. All the burning oil went with the front of the engine on the reduction gearbox. Went down. So he came into land. Taxied in on the remaining three engines, all that was fine. There was just a smother of oil, blackened front of the mountains of the port outer. I went back to debriefing, and they said, the farmer's just been on the phone. He said, he's a bit irate. He says, your prop landed in his farmyard. I said, well, good luck for him. What do you think I expected to do about it? I'm glad he got it, not me. So, We went in there, so we had to give a report on that. So, well, it's all right. We went, so we got the rest of the day off. So then we went back to the flight. Oh, Wally, all right then, Waitman, you'll be on tonight. No, I didn't go that one. I thought, well, this is fine. You know, I thought we got to, you know, have a few beers to celebrate this, get back again. No, no way. We were on again that night, the second operation, Operation Thunderclap. 24-hour sorties. So we were off again that night, and it was my birthday, incidentally, the 14th of October. I won't forget that in a hurry. So we went over, and we flew over there. I did bomb Duisburg, and it was the usual old routine. Flak all the way in, searchlights all over the place. Fighters, we back out again, back home, and we got our egg for breakfast, and that was the end of that one. That was a good weekend, that. But,
it was called Operation Thunderclap.
Pretty sure it was Operation Thunderclap. I'm not going to swear to it, but I'm fairly certain it was. The idea was to remove these. Eisenhower wanted the oil refineries attacked. But this Happy Valley flights, they weren't very good, really. And I can remember just other nights, many of them. We go, well, one in particular. Are you going out? Are you we used to set course over Reading, climb up from 7,000 feet, up from over Reading, and go out off Beachy Head, rather, somewhere like that. And across there, and I remember looking, we used to put the master bomber switch on then. And that meant, though, the bombs had all been on safe. If they'd fallen off by some accident, they wouldn't have gone off. They had the safety pins in. You switch the master pin to live, and that set the bombs live. The pins were withdrawn. So we every across the coast, we always had to put this master switch on live. We could see this night, we could see the stream ahead of us. We was all climbing and coming up the coast. It was not bright moonlight, but enough to see, wasn't it? Suddenly there was a great explosion ahead of us. The aeroplane blew up. So, Jesus. And so Cliff said to me, he's just put his master switch on. And I looked at him, I thought, yes. But then, not 2 minutes later, another one blew up. Two of them, as we crossed the coast. We went on, and I thought, well, I don't know. You know, that feeling, crossing the coast, putting that master switch on, what's going to happen? So I said to Reg, master switch on, Reg. Nothing happened. It went on. So I thought, oh, thank goodness for that. So we went on, it wasn't the master switch that blew them up. I'll tell you that later. But we went on and crossed the coast, and in we clocked right across over the French coast into towards Germany, and then we saw flares coming down, and a whole line of flares. And this was routine for the Ruhr. They had what they called illuminators. They had twin-engine fighters. They'd lay a stream of flares about 2 miles wide, either side of our track, and above us by about 2,000 feet, somewhere around about 20,000 feet. These flares slowly dropping, and it was like a major highway with street lights either side. I suppose these flares would be about half a mile or a mile apart, going right on for maybe 20 miles or more, lining up our route. I know they're night fighters. They had some good night fighters. The Ju-88 was excellent. They had the Me-110, Ju-88, and they would come in, and they would join the stream and fly along there, and with the illumination of these flares, where the bombers were, they didn't need radar, but they got it. They'd come down. And during that one particular night, all the way in, all the way out. I myself counted 29 oil fires on the ground. And those oil fires were aeroplanes. They had gone down, like 2 inches of round fire lying on the ground, just burning. First, I didn't know what they were. It was only later when I knew what had happened, that these were our aeroplanes burning on the ground. And the flak at the end of the flares, they just concentrated there, right the way into the target. The fighters came in above the Ju-88s and Me-110s. were the freelance single-engine fighters, the ME-109s and the FW-190s. They come in with a flak too, right over the target, and all the clouds, all illuminated by the flares and the fire and the gunfire and the searchlights, and you'd see the fighters diving in over the from there, the single engine fighters picking off their things. It's quite a night sometimes over the Ruhr. It's quite something. They're coming out, we've got the same thing, and you just didn't get a relief till you got over the French coast and back again. But there, that was the Ruhr. That was what it was all about. They had 60 miles of guns across there protecting that an area 60 miles wide and about 120 long. Nothing but heavy anti-aircraft guns. They could pile up a box barrage and you had to go through it. It was like a star-studded curtain at a cinema as it came down, and you had to go through that lot. But that was the job. That was what it was about, and you didn't think too much. You were more concerned about looking for fighters. At the there again, that was the Ruhr. Some of the other trips weren't too good. I can remember Wilhelmshaven one night. That was a rough trip too. Lovely over the North Sea, no problem, till we got over the coast, and then all hell broke loose. We went up there, and of all things, we went over the target, and a good run up the target. Cliff was a good bomb aimer. We always got an aiming point photograph. We had to take photographs of what we bombed, whether you liked it or not, and it was developed and pinned up on the wall when we got home. And we came back. You had to hold that aircraft straight and level after Cliff said bombs away, and they're about, I think it was 30 seconds. It might be 30 seconds, it might have been a minute, I can't remember. Or you had to hold that dead straight and level while the flash went off and photographed the target that you were aiming at. And of course you dropped a flash at the same time to lit up like a phosphorus flash, light up the ground and for the photos. And we're going up there, and he said bombs away, I did the other thing, put the nose down again, but I put that nose down and the aircraft went down like a lead balloon. So it wouldn't pull up, it wouldn't do anything, kept going down. There's nothing you could do about it. The damn thing, I thought, he pulled back. I've got Cliff down the bottom. I said, what's going on? Check the bomb. So he went back there and they took the bomb inspection covers. Yes, the full bomb load was on. By that time, I'd evened out and we were right down low. And he got it out and flogged back towards the coast there, and all the bombs are on. And he says, the master switch hadn't worked. The damn thing hadn't pulled the plins out and the bombs were on. Of course, he went down to full load of flipping bombs and petrol. I mean, flogging back up there again, and I didn't go all the way up. Flogged back, turned back in again, go through it again, drop the bombs, and back home. That was fine. They'd cross over the coast. It was daylight now. We need a cup of tea after that lot. So we got out, come the flask, and we settled down. We're diving back down about 7,000 feet. A nice morning, clear as a bell, coming back over there. So it was just a cup of coffee out the flask, about halfway over the North Sea or more. And then all the flipping tracers started coming up. Red. Well, red tracer was ours. We had red tracer, so I knew what that was. They were firing up from down below. It was a flipping convoy. And they were picking on us. And they were our own convoy, and they were coming up there. I said to Tommy, where's that coming from, Tommy, the mid-upper? He said, I can't see anything. Well, I could. So I just banged the throttles wide open and dived right down to sea level and got a belt of speed on that old Halifax. It shouldn't ought to do. But it already done over 240 knots on the way down, so I thought, well, that won't hurt it. We got away from it, and it was one of these North Sea convoys going up. They didn't care what aeroplane they shot at, as long as it was flying. We got away and thought, well, this isn't on. We're nearly home. We're looking back to our eggs and bacon, or beans and beans on toast, and the flipping people to start firing at us after a night like this. But it was all part of the game, wasn't it? That's what it's all about.
That was 15th of October, 1944.
Was it? I couldn't tell you the date. I remember it, though.
Any other ones that stick out in your mind?
Yes, yeah. Well, these don't stick out. Actually, they're coming back as I'm talking to you, really. It's because a lot of them were very similar. Now, Kiel, that was another rough old target to go to. Of course, that was being a German naval base, it would be. And I remember one night over Kiel, I think this was a Sunday night too. And everything seemed to happen to me on a Sunday. Well, that was a hectic night. Searchlights everywhere. There was flak all over the place. Bombs going off all over the place, it seemed. And suddenly, and with all the searchlights reflecting back off the clouds, I saw an aeroplane coming straight for me. All I could see was a big radial engine. And I saw it was a Fokker Wolf 190. And it was coming at a rate of knots, and so were we. So I thought, oh dear. I thought nothing of it. I just pulled the control column back and opened the throttle wide and climbed. Well, that was a stupid thing to do with a Halifax loading with there. But I think that Luftwaffe pilot dived. We both did the wrong thing if we did. He was a fighter. He should have climbed, I should have dived, but we both did the opposite thing. And I thought, he's taken our trailing arrow away, he was so close. He didn't, but I levelled off, and I was a bit apprehensive for a minute. I thought he could have turned around and come back onto us, but he didn't. And I reckon he was just counting his lucky bees like I was. I reckon he'd had as big a fright as I did, because we were so close. It was a head-on collision, and I thought I certainly didn't want to have a collision with a German night fighter. I mean, that's not the way to go.
That appears to be in the 16th of August, 44.
I don't know. I tell you, I can't remember them in sequence, you know. These are just coming back at various times.
Got a commendation in your logbook from, presumably, your commanding officer, who said that you completed your tour without having been involved in any accidents, or even having an unnecessary cancellation or abandonment of an operational sortie. Did that actually happen to some pilots?
Yes, that was a green endorsement. Some did get it. You know, I don't know. It was quite a commendation to get. It was worth more to a pilot than than a lot of other things. It was something to be proud of in many ways. But at the time, I didn't think of cancellation. When you got into an aeroplane and you run the engines up, the last thing you wanted was a mag drop. If you got a mag drop at 200 revs, you'd have it seen to you because you knew it wouldn't go. And I was fortunate. If I had a mag drop, it was within limits. And I admit that a lot of people, if they got a mag drop, that was when the magnetos weren't firing properly and the engines weren't giving off the full revs, they would pack it in too easily, I thought. But I never thought about that. Once you're in the aeroplane, all you want to do is get underway, because there were so many things to think about.
Did you ever come across any so-called lack of moral fibre cases?
Not on my units, I didn't, no. No, I'd heard of people that were going sick because they couldn't stand it any longer, but I didn't find any on my unit, but I did hear of them, and a lot of them, they had a place at Sheffield. I used to send them to Sheffield for discipline training, as they called it, and really, it was a former glass house, and they dealt with them there, but I never ran across any myself. I think air crew, anyway, they were volunteers to start with. And they knew what they were in for. There was no conscription in flying. That was it. Yeah, I mean, they had volunteered for it and they'd got to put up with it.
But did you know of people who cancelled or abandoned operations when they should not have done so?
Not deliberately, because there's no way of proving it. If somebody came back who got some trouble with his engine, he'd usually got some trouble. But whether it was sufficient to come back was anybody's guess, you know. I think sometimes on this squadron, they did have some unnecessary turnbacks. I think they could have pressed on with three engines, the other one giving some power, but not necessarily enough. I think we did have some of that, because I can remember the talk going on the squadron that so-and-so turned back last night. I don't know what was the matter with him. You know, that sort of thing.
There is one entry you've got here that you read in Le Havre. There's quite a lot of controversy about the RAF attacks on there because people say it was an unnecessary attack on them. Do you remember anything about that?
That was on Le Havre, was it?
Yes.
Le Havre that's a chain of memory. And Boulogne. Yes, these people did have a lot of argument recently about that, but they don't know the facts, obviously, or they never bothered to trace them or to find out what they were. Now, at the time, I think I'll associate both together. I'm not too sure. I believe it was Boulogne and Le Havre, but Le Havre anyway, the German garrison was holding out, and it was surrounded with heavy artillery. The population of Le Havre, their water supplies, the public utilities, excuse me, I'm getting a little hoarse, they were scarce. They were going down, the food was scarce, and the water was contaminated, and they were living in shelters. It was terrible, and they couldn't get out. The Germans were keeping them underground, and the defense was so intense from this heavy artillery, the army couldn't get in, and the more they were battering, the more they were damaging the civilian population. So they called Eisenhower called in Bomber Command. And our job was to remove those heavy guns. Now, if I remember rightly, we went to my squadron, we had two attacks on that, I'm not too sure. And the first one was abandoned, I believe, because the target was obscured, obscured sufficiently to ensure that we didn't get our good targets. And our job was to remove those guns. And when we did get a good view, we went in and we did bomb those guns. And the army moved in after we'd done that. After we removed those guns, the army did move in and take Le Havre. And there obviously would be civilian casualties because the guns were, not only were they on the perimeter, they were inside. They had to be, but it was unfortunately a fortunate of war. We lost aeroplanes on it. They lost people, but they were relieved. The British Army moved in, and they were saved from that. There were a lot of casualties, but then this is war.
Do you remember much about those raids on V1 sites?
Yeah, I did a lot of those, the V1 and the V2 sites, actually. Well, I say a lot. I mean, I did several. A lot of the places, you know, like the Forêt de Nieppe was one, and several others. They have French names I can't remember now. And they were V1 sites. They're ski slopes, concrete slopes, and they're usually in a wooded area. And at the time then, London was being bombarded, the southeast of England was being bombarded with these rockets. And actually, we had the task of taking them out, as we called it. And the idea was to saturate and bomb them. Because there's no way that we could do anything except get the storehouses around them, which were deep underground, or the ski slopes themselves, or in the case of the rockets, the transporters and the rocket pylons that they went on. So you had to destroy what was all around. So we did that. And at that time, there was a terrific, virtually carnage in London and the South East with these flying bombs. They were terrible things, terrible weapons, because they came on their own. And the actual rocket, the first time you heard that, was at Gravesend. I was in bed when one came up the field at the top. You didn't hear it. It came through the sound barrier and then exploded. And the flying bombs, as many times in Gravesend, I've been on leave there, they were coming over. They were like a horde of two-stroke motorbikes going. When the engine cut out, it meant the bomb was coming down. And that was the only warning you got, was that engine stopped, and you took a dive. But yes, we did.